Balance your trading strategy by adding futures. CME Group helps you manage risk and capture opportunities in all market environments. Capitalize on around-the-clock access to highly liquid global futures and options market across all major asset classes. Just visit your online broker and get started. Plug into valuable educational materials and trading tools and see what adding futures can do for you at cmegroup.com/onthetape. iConnections is the world's largest capital introduction platform in the alternative investment industry. iConnections membership-only platform brings together the asset management community, providing allocators and managers with the opportunity to connect both physically and virtually. With an impressive network of over 4,000 allocators and 900 managers, their community oversees an astounding $48 trillion and $16 trillion in assets, respectively. iConnections is also the driving force behind the alternative investment industry's most renowned in-person events. We invite you to join iConnections at their upcoming event, SALT iConnections in New York, taking place on May 20th through the 21st at the Glass House in New York City. This two-day event is packed with one-on-one cap intro meetings and content. To explore more about iConnections events and gain access to their members-only platform, visit iConnections.io.
When you're trading options, Fidelity has just what you need, with straightforward but powerful tools to help you select a strategy and execute your ideas. And they offer a wide range of information and insights to help simplify your trading experience. Have a question? Ask it live during their small classes and coaching sessions. Need information? Check out their educational videos, articles, and webinars. See why it's easy to trade options your way at Fidelity. Start now at fidelity.com/options.
Options trading entails significant risk and is not appropriate for all investors. Certain complex option strategies carry additional risks. Before trading options, contact Fidelity Investments by calling 800-544-5115 to receive a copy of Characteristics and Risks of Standardized Options. Supporting documentation for any claims, if applicable, will be furnished upon request. Welcome back to the On the Tape podcast, Guy Adami, typically joined by Dan Nathan and Danny Moses. Today, just by the great Danny Moses. By the way, Danny and I had a great conversation with Mike Cow. He's the urban cowboy on the Twitter. You should follow him because the man is a genius. And it was a fascinating conversation about a lot of things that Danny and I have been talking about. And obviously, some of the things that he's been seeing as well. Danny Moses, how are you?
I'm good. It's Masters Week, baby.
All right, let's talk about that for a sec. See, for me, there are a number of different things, right? You get towards spring. You got the Daytona 500. All those things lead up to the start of baseball season, hockey playoffs coming up. But for some reason, Masters Weekend is when the clock turns and when you say, okay, we are now in the throes of spring. Is that the way you look at it?
I always look at it as you got the Super Bowl, right? And then that's right in the middle of winter, get through. And then once March Madness happens, that happens, Final Four, and then it takes you into the Masters, and then you're through the gauntlet, so to speak.
The winter in this area, being the New York City metropolitan area, typically starts in October-ish, and it runs through March, sometimes into April. And man, that can be a brutal 6 months. So you live for the short period of spring that you actually do get before you hit summer, where things become insufferable at times due to the heat and the humidity. People ask, why do you live in that area? I don't know the answer to that, Danny. I don't know. That's why you go down to Florida for some of the year. You're in Connecticut. You bounce around.
Yeah, but you need adversity in your life to get you motivated. And listen, I love the change of seasons. And I just want to say before we get into it today, my dad was born in Augusta, Georgia. My family is from Georgia. I've had a tie to that. Of course, I've never been asked to play that club, but I've attended the tournament for it. There's an extra special place for me with that tournament.
I have never been. It looks spectacular. People that have gone absolutely love it. That's sort of on the G-Swizz bucket list. I think the Kentucky Derby is on that list. I know you've probably been a number of times. The Masters should be on that list. I think the Indianapolis 500 is one of those great Americana type of events that everybody should probably go to once. Pebble Beach, which I'm sure you've been to, is one of those events. There are certain things that almost by definition you should do. Hopefully I'll get around to it at some point before I get too old, and the clock is ticking for sure. But you know what else the clock is ticking? Look at that segue. It's ticking on the Federal Reserve in the form of what we heard earlier this week. CPI on Wednesday, PPI on Thursday. Now, the optimist will say PPI didn't really reinforce or didn't galvanize some of the CPI readings. I think it's apples to oranges, in my opinion. I've thought for a while, as have you, that we have a huge problem on the inflation front that the market's not taking into consideration. And here we are. Before we talk about the heroic move in gold, which you've been all over, let's talk about those readings and what you think they mean.
Wonder Twin powers activate. I don't know if the Wonder Twins are Powell and Yellen or the PPIs and the CPIs, or it might be, but certainly the reactions are wild. And again, you want to believe the market trades longer term, it trades on fundamentals, but these short-term reactions, which I keep saying, yesterday you could have taken advantage of buying some things, today take advantage of selling some things, just on small changes in these expectations, right, on these spreads. So we've gone in Fed fund futures. We're now 50-50 in July. It was 42-58 yesterday, forward versus against. And in September, it's now 70-30 from 65-35. So it's amazing. And those aren't big moves and they can change from time to time. But again, I look at the components guy within each of those things. And when you think about PPI, you think about gasoline, which was actually a low reading, you know that's going to change and come back to bite. So a lot of these things are fluid, but I think everyone's pretty comfortable that, I mean, I don't know if you are necessarily, we're not going to see a quote reacceleration. I just don't know if we're going to see the precipitous drop that people are expecting towards a 2%. And you and I both know that if the economy starts to weaken and kind of inflation just holds or gets a little bit less, the Fed is going to be willing or wanting to cut. And I believe that will be self-defeating because of what we've already seen in the anticipation of commodity prices themselves and the impact that's having on CPI and other readings. So I feel like we're kind of boxed in here, but for the time being, here we go. Let's turn the calendar to earnings season. What really matters, fundamentals of companies, which, you know, we're 2 years through this thing now at this point, guys. So these companies that have proven their models can work, you got to believe that they're going to keep working. And so I think we're going to continue to see the haves and the have nots in the world of earnings and companies as we move through this particular earnings season.
This is just my sense. I think that will manifest itself most in the retailers. And we've seen it around the edges in terms of some of these retailers. The have and the have nots in the space are stark. And, you know, it was a couple of years ago, you were talking about why you thought Walmart was a great stock to own. And quite frankly, that's a stock that continually makes seemingly all-time highs, not necessarily on a daily basis, but pretty much on a weekly basis. And people will knock Walmart on valuation, which I can sort of understand. But you think about how the world sets up for them. And this is sort of the world that Walmart was created for. On the flip side of that coin, though, what you're seeing for the first time in a long time is you're seeing weakness on the very low end of the spectrum in terms of the retailers through the dollar stores. And now you're starting to see it, Danny, on the higher end in the forms of the PVH and to a certain extent, a Lululemon and some of those names, which I haven't seen in quite some time. And you layer on top of that a McDonald's, which a month or so ago, the CFO came out and basically said, and I had never heard this from McDonald's in the 17 years I've been doing Fast Money, that their customer was starting to feel the pinch in terms of prices. So think about that for a second, because historically McDonald's wins to that. Now they're saying, wait a second, we're actually starting to feel the pain as well. So people will say you're cherry picking guy, maybe, but you can't dismiss when a McDonald's starts to tell you that their consumer is feeling the pinch. So I'm with you 100% in terms of, you know, you're going to know who the have and the have nots are over the next few weeks for sure.
When you look at a CarMax, which kind of gave you a look into what's happening, maybe for that McDonald's customer a little bit, this is the quote: "We believe vehicle affordability challenges continue to impact our fourth quarter unit sales performance." This is their fiscal fourth quarter, with ongoing headwinds due to widespread inflationary pressures, higher interest rates, tightening lending standards, and a low consumer confidence. They basically were saying that they can equate what used to be a $400 payment in a car is now $530. I mean, the math is just that simple. And so you're right. You're starting to see, I think, both on the high end and the low and more discerning spending going on, which is why Walmart's getting the benefit of a lot of this, as we've talked about before, from a market share perspective. Walmart stock, I believe, was up yesterday during that sell-off, or flat to up yesterday. So that's going to show to be defensive in nature. And amazingly, Amazon, I think we should focus on today, which finally blasted through its all-time high. It took years to get back there. It was 2021. Andy Jassy, ahead of their earnings, put out kind of his annual letter. And he's like, I am all in on AI. We are the AI company. He's not just blowing smoke to get a stock price up. You want to just reiterate. He also said, interesting guy, I don't know we're going to get into this. Competition is coming for NVIDIA. Okay, so this AI, it's great. It's a secular growth story. I'm not going to get run over by it. But at the same time, these chips are hardware. And Amazon talks about their own chips and how they will also migrate off of the NVIDIA quote platform over time. So this is going to be an ongoing growth industry, obviously, with winners, a lot of winners and some losers. But more importantly, I think it's where we are in the cycle. And to a point you just made, there's a retail cycle for the consumer. There's a tech cycle for enterprise. And so you got to find that niche and find the growth areas and feel good. And you know what? People can feel good about owning Amazon here, right? They're growing. They're pulling a lot of different levers. And now he's not changed his focus, but is prioritizing his focus. And I think that got people thinking, even gave them another excuse, guy, to take some of these names up.
Without question. And you mentioned Amazon correctly. You know, I'll throw Google in there as well, which finally that stock has gotten through its prior all-time high. And now they're probably seeing some of the tailwinds. I think part of the story that's going on here, and again, I want to be clear, you know, as we're sitting here today on Thursday afternoon, NVIDIA is basically trading $900 a share. On Wednesday of this week, the stock traded almost as low as $835 a share. So it's had a pretty big bounce. I mentioned that in the context still that March 8th, Friday, March 8th, I encourage people to go back and look at that day, that engulfing pattern that we saw in NVIDIA that day, where from peak to trough, the stock lost approximately $250 billion in market cap. Again, for context, I think there are only 55 or 60 companies in the world that have that market cap in the first place. And that stock lost it over the course of a couple hours that day. By the way, that engulfing pattern has not been violated. It was tested to the upside a couple of times in the ensuing week, but it has not been tested since. And I will still say, until I'm proven wrong, and that might happen next week, that March 8th is a day we will come back and look and say, ah, that was it for NVIDIA. And now you're backing it up with some of the commentary you're hearing about competition coming. And quickly, in terms of inflation, Jeff Currie in our world is an absolute legend. He was at Goldman Sachs for a couple decades. He recently left to go to the Carlyle Group. He was on CNBC earlier this week, Danny. And one of the points that he made was he is seeing across a swath of different commodities. What he basically said was, if it was one commodity rallying, I wouldn't be concerned. If it was two or three, not so much. We are seeing price increases across soft commodities. We're seeing price increases across industrial metals, precious metals, energy, and everything in between. And I think he was somewhat, you know, I don't know what the word is, but alarmed by the strength in the commodity sector. And I think through that lens, he isn't convinced that the inflation dragon has been slayed at all. So I encourage people to go and take a look at that. With all that said, all loads have been leading to, and you've been talking about this for quite a long time, the fact that gold is going to have its day. And it's having it for a myriad of different reasons. And we're going to talk to Mike Cao about this without question. I'm curious as to his thoughts, but gold is rallying in an environment where, counterintuitively, it shouldn't be rallying. What do I mean by that? 10-year yields have gone from 3.8% to 4.5%. The dollar's been rallying. This actually, historically, should be tremendous headwind. Gold has been rallying despite that. And as we sit here today, we're approaching $2,400 an ounce. So let's dissect that for a minute, because I absolutely think whether you want to own gold, don't own gold, the warning signs it's flashing, I think, are something to take into consideration.
You've been on this gold trade, obviously, for a long time. Throughout your entire career, you've traded gold. So I defer to you on this and how it's acted. You and I both noticed that it was acting in a way that was unnatural in the sense of it being in a, I call it a bull pattern or whatever you want to call it. So I mentioned, I think, last week, kind of the size of the above ground metric tonnage of gold. And I want to put this back in perspective because I went back and looked. This is not the ETFs. It has nothing to do with anything. There are supposedly about 210,000 metric tons that are above ground, right? And so you have 35,000 basically ounces in a metric ton. You can do the math. You're looking at almost a $17 trillion kind of market that you're looking at, again, just the above ground. what we're seeing in kind of gold and the way people have begun to express it, you are starting to see, Guy, I think you would agree, a little bit of retail participation coming in through some of these ETFs, some of these gold miner ETFs, these 2X. We've talked about these things ad nauseum. I've played it on PHYS. You can play it through Sprott, this SII stock, which you look at that thing. I mean, they have funds for uranium and gold. A lot of different ways to play it where it's not basically direct. But I think what we are seeing, Guy, and you can talk about this, I turn it back to you, is that central banks demand for this, specifically China. And that probably has to do with other commodities as well, hoarding. The weird thing to me, Guy, is you have certain metals and commodities like silver, which are much more tied to economic growth and economic activity. And I think that's where people are getting a little bit confused. You're right. It's all commodities moving up right now at this point. And I can't explain every commodity, palladium and so forth, and all these things that are moving together, because you could identify various supply and demand reasons for both. But I think it goes back to one thing, Guy. I think there's a geopolitical risk that's really starting to get priced into the market globally. I think that's happening. And what you always talk about is central banks hedging their own incompetence over time. And I think we're seeing both in real time here happen. So, you know, again, I said this a month ago when the market was still rallying, but gold was rallying with it. I thought that was a warning sign to people, just wake up, something else is going on here. So I turn it back to you to talk about kind of the central bank's role in all of this in terms of how gold is behaving.
You know, I've said for a while that I think the buying that central banks have been doing, and by the way, for you new listeners, in 2022, global central banks bought approximately 1,131 tons worth of gold for roughly $71 billion. That was a record at the time. They did similar last year, and they're probably on pace to do similar this year. And what I've been saying, what Danny just mentioned, is they are effectively hedging their own ineptitude, because I do believe that they see the problems that they've created, without question. Japan, to me, has a huge problem. And again, we'll speak to Mike about that. And that's manifesting itself in the weakness in their currency, which is eye-opening in a word. But in terms of gold, as I said, this should be an environment where gold isn't trading particularly well, yet we find ourselves trading at all-time highs. And Danny mentioned silver. Let me mention this as well. We've established that gold's at its all-time high. The all-time high in silver was either side of $50 an ounce. So depending on what you're looking at today, we are still roughly, and I say roughly, 50% below its prior all-time high for a myriad of different reasons. But there is a catch-up trade about to happen. And Danny mentioned this, and I say this too. Gold is a commodity in name only. It doesn't really have an end use per se, whereas some of these other commodities clearly do. Silver happens to be one of those commodities, and there's an industrial use for it. And by the way, a lot of these technology companies use silver as well. The one stock that I'd look at if you want to sort of show a position or have a position in silver vis-a-vis equities, Pan American Silver, the symbol there is PAAS. This was a $13 stock in February. By the way, a stock that had done nothing for a very long time. As we're sitting here today, it's now $19.50. So in percentage terms, you can do the math. This stock has rallied almost 50% over the last couple of months. I still think there's room to the upside. So Danny mentioned silver. I'm with him on this. I think silver, not enough people are paying attention. And if things continue to manifest themselves in ways that I think are happening with some of these currency moves, I think people are going to find themselves into silver. You want to also talk about, and I think this is important, I believe, again, correctly, incorrectly, and I've thought this for a while, one of the reasons yields were going to go higher, one of the many reasons, is because of supply and demand. These different treasury auctions are going to take place. And not that the market was not going to buy U.S., that's not my point, but they would demand a higher rate of interest to do so. And to a certain extent, Danny, we saw it this week in a couple different treasury auctions. The one on Wednesday was, in a word, a disaster. The one on Thursday was a little bit better. Neither one of them were particularly good.
Yeah, listen, this is why Yellen does what she does. She needs this market to hold. I guess rates sold because there's a lot of debt to issue. Talk about bad timing for a 10-year auction when everything was going on with the CPI print. But that being said, $39 billion auction. And again, dealers, who's talking about investment banks, if you want to think about it that way, are holding a larger percentage on and on, which I believe, Guy, we'll save it for another episode. At some point, the Treasury and Fed will basically lower the leverage ratios that treasuries take up on some of these balance sheets for these banks in order so they can provide a little bit more liquidity into the market. But This is the part, Guy, and let's take it over to Japan for a second on this, because I want to harp on something. It's when these auctions start to happen that you start to look under the sheets, so to speak, right? It's okay, does it really mean anything? What is it? And then you start to really look at the United States balance sheet and the Japanese balance sheet. I'll go to that in a second, has kind of underwrite that itself. And what does it really mean? It means almost $35 trillion in debt, $2-3 trillion we need to issue this year of paper. You start to do the math on that. Believe me, you don't want to do the math on that, because let's live in this world of AI and tech craze and so forth and just buy stocks and not worry about it. But when you start to see and you start to think that next leg, it really becomes kind of a bleak picture, Guy. We've talked about this kind of at length. So that's why these auctions are so crucial. And, you know, again, Yellen in the first quarter makes an assumption on what she's going to be issuing, obviously, for the next quarter. And God forbid the GDP slows or tax receipts aren't as big as we would have thought. Like, you know what? I'm going to up it just a little bit. So she controlled the narrative late last year, was able to calm yields down, right? Certainly the 10-year yield is the kind of the biggest one the proxy everyone looks at. But I worry about a period of time where supply and demand actually is the driving force for yields versus just what inflation expectations are. And that's scary. Moving over to Japan for a minute, watching their 10-year yields themselves. Again, we're talking about 0.87%, so under 1%, but let's just put that in context. They were effectively 30 basis points last year. They need to start making a decision. Do they defend their currency, the yen, which is now weakening through 153 versus the dollar? Or do they go out and bring Janet Jackson back to tour Japan again for yield curve control? What do they need to pick? I'm going to put this in context. They had their reckoning in 1990. What was the exact level the yen went through during that time period in 1989-90? 153. But their debt to GDP at that point for Japan was 67%. It's now north of 260% debt to GDP. I want to say that it was 6% yields, 5, 6% yields then, and now it's 0.87. But I think you get where I'm going with this. Where did we begin our crisis in 2008 before we started issuing all this paper? 67% debt to GDP. We're at 130. So again, these trends, we've been issuing so much paper globally to kind of mask anything else going on. And I just feel like at some point, Guy, all this comes back to roost. But make no mistake about it, Yellen has a tough job cut out for her. And hopefully these yields can stay contained. I'm not going to try to predict where they're going to be. But when it starts to become about supply and demand, and we have auctions that don't go well, God forbid, failed auctions, look out, because that is a non-fundamental thing that people are not paying attention to, Guy.
Could not agree more. And we're not trying to be hyperbolic here. We're not doomsdayers here. But the numbers are what they are. I mean, we're not making these numbers up. And as long as you can skate through, to Danny's point about Janet Yellen and Treasury, everybody will be okay. Nobody make a move. We'll all get out of here okay, type of thing. And then invariably during those movies, like something falls off a ledge and it startles somebody, and then all the guns start to go off. So it's that event that nobody's waiting for. Everybody's standing quiet, waiting for somebody to make a move. And then something happens, a rock falls off a cliff, and everybody starts to fire. And I don't know what that rock falling off the cliff is going to be, but we're seeing it around the edges and all these different ancillary things. And, you know, for me, dollar yen is, you know, I don't want to say the linchpin to all this thing, and it might not make sense to a lot of people, but I think the dominoes will start to fall in the form of what the yen does over the next couple of weeks. So keep that in mind. And your point about debt to GDP levels, just say this. I don't think there's been a developed economy that's been able to recover from debt to GDP levels north of 130%. You can go back and look. And as Danny said, we're fast approaching that. And I think there are people that pay attention to this shit, like a Luke Groman, for example, that understand. And there are other people that say it doesn't matter because we can print our way out. We shall see. But I'll tell you what else, Danny. One of the other things we've been talking about for a while that have traded extraordinarily well has been the energy sector. And as we sit here today, you have an OIH that traded as high as 345. You have an XLE that's probably approaching its prior highs. You have these refining stocks, Valero, some of the other refiners, PSX, and some of these other names continue to be on their horse. I think, again, just my opinion, I don't want to say they're just getting started because they've had tremendous moves, but I don't think if you were to foray into energy right now, I don't think you've missed the entire move. Thoughts on that?
I couldn't agree more. And again, you and I have been on the same side of this for a while. We go back to the beginning of 2023. The expectations were very high for the energy sector. People came into the year positioned defensively, owning energy and financials, and the opposite happened. Tech took off. We've talked about that. This year was the exact opposite. I think the energy sector within the S&P was almost as low as 5% or 5.5% of the S&P as an allocation because all the portfolio managers were busy chasing tech. So We saw what ESG did to the sector. We saw how unloved it became. We've been talking about energy M&A, mergers and acquisitions for a long time, a couple of years, and it keeps heating up. Who cares if Washington ends up approving it? The point is that these companies are much healthier than they have been. And the other thing we talk about is higher prices, not energy prices, stock prices in a sector beget higher prices, meaning these portfolio managers who have been underweight energy, and I believe still are substantially, are forced to chase the moves. And you start to see these incremental step up in these stocks. That being said, Guy, on an absolute basis, certainly relative to the commodity, they're very cheap. And I'm not talking about natural gas in certain areas of Texas and companies that are exposed. We're talking about really oil in general is kind of what we're focused on here. The oil heavy names, the Exxon Mobils of the world, you know, large integrated, some of the refiners, which you've talked about kind of ad nauseum. And here we sit. And on an absolute basis, to your point, yes, they've had a run. Are they expensive? Absolutely not. And I could not agree with you more. And as we go through, I think, the earnings cycle through this quarter and throughout the rest of the year, relative to me, it's a safe place to be, especially while commodities have a bid. And Guy, there's the key component of all of this to me, I think, if you told people that China's okay from an economic perspective, like that they're okay, I think that would give people a little bit more confidence. We are starting to see signs that China's is starting to bottom out from an economic perspective, which does explain, Guy, some of the strength just in all these types of commodities in general. But I think that's the big leg. And obviously, there's nothing that's going to calm down, unfortunately, in the Middle East over the next several months and probably several years. And so certainly watch it. But as we were tinkering on oil kind of $70 to $75 not too long ago, it became hard to feel confident that you can own these companies. I think you can own them even if oil does pull back. So I'll end it by saying, even if oil does pull back, and hopefully it's for reasons that there's some type of calm in the Middle East, if those energy stocks sell off, I'd buy them all.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I'm glad you brought up Chinese stocks. We have mentioned the FXI for a while now. And I thought back in January, middle of January, when the FXI traded down to and held sort of the 21 level, of course, the 21 level being sort of the low that we saw in October of 2022, and then you go all the way back to the financial crisis of 08-09 when the FXI traded down to 21. I'm like, okay, here's your entry point. Now, with that said, it's not like the FXI has exploded higher. As we're sitting here today, it's trading $24.70. So that's not a huge move to the upside. But Danny makes a good point. You might have seen a bottoming in some of these equities. And then I'll just throw at you an Alibaba, which, again, has not traded particularly well. As we're sitting here today, it's trading 74 and three quarters thereabouts. But I'll point to that same time period, that January level, and say, you know what? Things started to turn. So if you're looking for counterintuitive, non-consensus trades, I think being long the FXI will give you a buffer. I think if you're looking for individual stocks, I think Alibaba is really interesting here as well, Danny. So I'm glad you brought that up.
If you're bullish on the U.S. economy and bullish kind of on the global consumer, then you have to believe that China is, quote, okay. But on a relative basis, if that's your viewpoint, then China is going to have some type of catch-up trade going on. However, I will say that this is meaningless, obviously. I bring it up. Fitch downgraded their outlook on China to a negative from a stable with an A-plus rating, so they were never double or triple A. Moody's had already done that. Just starting to think that if I worked at Fitch, might not want to take a trip to China anytime soon, because we know what they've been doing also, Guy, technically controlling their markets, banning short selling, taking funds out that are shorting anything that want to sell futures. So there is a technical manipulation going on. But that being said, that certainly can be supportive, obviously, of the markets themselves.
As people are listening to this on Friday or Saturday, we will have heard from a number of banks, and I'm not asking you to trade individual names, but I'm just curious as to your thoughts, the importance of bank earnings for this period of time. Obviously, we start earnings season with these banks. What importance, if any, do you put in them?
You got, obviously, the granddaddy of them all, where it's reports tomorrow morning, JP Morgan, who I think is the most important bank. They have exposure to a little bit of everything. Jamie Dimon already has been pretty outspoken what his viewpoints are, so I don't think it'll be a shock to anybody. I think it comes down to credit reserves and credit metrics, which I think are going to be fine. We know that you've had a huge growth in non-bank lending with private credit and so forth. So you're not going to see a huge acceleration, but I don't think anyone's expecting that in the loan book. These are steady eddies. They're going to want to know about return of capital. They're going to know about Basel III implementations, which, you know, all that nonsense stuff. So I don't think it's going to be anything sexy. We know that M&A has picked up. We're hopeful or believe that the IPO calendar itself, we know, has picked up. We know that banks are exposed. But I'll go back to what I do every bank earnings season. It's not the XLF. You need to look at these companies on an individual basis. Some are exposed. We just talked about kind of CarMax and lower-end consumers starting to get it. Some are exposed to lower-end consumer. Some aren't. They all exposed to all kinds of consumer, but some are more weighted. American Express is more weighted to the higher end. So a lot of the stuff is kind of out there, somewhat telegraphed. I don't expect there to be huge, but you got JP Morgan, BlackRock, Citi, State Street, and Wells Fargo on one day, which is tomorrow. And then next week, obviously, more banks. And then you get the Johnson & Johnson, the Netflix, the Procter & Gamble. So again, I love, because I'm a nerd, reading these transcripts without hearing anyone else's opinion yourself. And I highly recommend that to people. You can do it rather quickly and just to view it yourself and go through it. So Guy, I'm not expecting anything that's going to be earth-shattering on these companies at all. But I don't think there's going to be a reason to sell them either, no matter what these companies report, because to me, banks are like utilities at this point.
Towards the end of this month, we will have the NFL draft where the Giants will be picking number 6. There are a lot of people out there, I am not one of them, that would like the Giants to pick one of the many quarterbacks in this draft. If the Minnesota Vikings, or any team for that matter, would want to move up and take that pick from the Giants to pick any one of these quarterbacks, be my guest. We will break that down when the time comes. However, what I'd like to hear from Danny Moses now, as we're probably, as you're listening this, into day 2 of the Masters, who emerges victorious? Who dons the green jacket on Sunday afternoon, or Sunday early evening, I should say?
Well, I don't want to, you know, obviously cheat here because they're already on the front nine of the first round, but it's hard to see anyone beating Scottie Scheffler if he can putt. I was hopeful that McIlroy, this is it here, I think he's over par right now, could do something because no one's expecting him to win it this year, so it could be the time, but I guess you got to believe it's Scottie Scheffler that probably wins this thing. But I want to believe that Rory McIlroy has a 65 in him somewhere on one of these days, and now that the weather's going to clear up. So Scheffler's the obvious pick. He's the best ball striker out there, but I'm going to go with backup with Rory McIlroy. So can I give you two?
Absolutely. Two things here? This is your podcast. When we come back, Mike Cowell, ladies and gentlemen, stick around. With CME Group's micro-sized futures and options, you can access the same transparency and liquidity of the benchmark contracts with less upfront financial commitment. Diversify your portfolio and manage your exposure with the flexibility of CME Group micro-contracts in crypto, metals, FX, energy, and equity indices. Learn more about what adding futures can do for you at cmegroup.com/micros. iConnections is the world's largest capital introduction platform in the alternative investment industry. iConnections membership-only platform brings together the asset management community, providing allocators and managers with the opportunity to connect both physically and virtually. With an impressive network of over 4,000 allocators and 900 managers, their community oversees an astounding $48 trillion and $16 trillion in assets, respectively. iConnections is also the driving force behind the alternative investment industry's most renowned in-person events. We invite you to join iConnections at their upcoming event, Salt iConnections in New York, taking place on May 20th through the 21st at the Glass House in New York City. This two-day event is packed with one-on-one cap intro meetings and content. To explore more about iConnections events and gain access to their members-only platform, visit iConnections.io. Trading options might be new for you, or maybe you've been doing it for a while. Either way, Fidelity is your go-to source for clear and relevant information about trading options. For example, ask Fidelity professionals questions during their live small classes and coaching sessions and learn more with educational videos, articles, and webinars. Plus, with Fidelity's straightforward tools and technology, you'll find it easier than ever to trade options your way. See what's waiting for you at fidelity.com/options. Options trading entails significant risk and is not appropriate for all investors. Certain complex option strategies carry additional risks. Before trading options, contact Fidelity Investments by calling 800-544-5115 to receive a copy of Characteristics and Risks of Standardized Options. Supporting documentation for any claims, if applicable, will be furnished upon request. Welcome back to the On the Tape podcast. Danny Moses, Guy Adami, you're in for a treat. It was September 13th of last year when Mike Cowell sat down with us and had a conversation. So many of the things we talked about then are coming to fruition now. And if you don't follow him on Twitter, you're doing Twitter wrong. It's at Urban Cowboy. I'll spell it. KAOBOY. You absolutely have to follow him. His musings are worth the price of admission. Michael, how are you?
I'm doing great. Great to be back with you guys.
No, and it's our honor to have you back. And the timing couldn't be better because so many of the things that we talked about back in September, as I said, are starting to sort of play out. But at a 30,000-foot level, talk to us about what we've been seeing since then and some of the things that are sticking out to you.
Over the weekend, I wrote a piece, play on words. I called it the Battle of the Bads. Remember the good old Battle of the Bands back in high school? In this case, I'm referring to the terrible, I call them the Scylla Charybdis choices facing a whole bunch of constituencies. So whether it's the BOJ, the ECB, the Fed, OPEC Plus. So in that post, I go through each one and then think through the potential repercussions and feedback loops. But I think as we're talking about today, after this very hot CPI print, we are seeing for the first time dollar yen break out above that, call it that no pass zone of 152, which has basically been like the intervention zone the last three times it tested it, and it finally broke out today. And it's scary.
So Michael, we harp on this a lot, and we do focus on dollar yen, and we try to get people to care. We try to tell them why they should care. Maybe break down a little bit the mechanics of it. But if the yen really does start to break down, what can the BOJ even do at this point? They can talk intervention, they can try to do something, but is it just a fool's errand? And just talk a little bit about the repercussions of actually the yen breaking down substantially.
In my post, actually, I talked about the BOJ and MOF's dilemma, right? So there are two choices. I call them the bad versus batter choice. They can either choose to defend JGBs or defend the JPY. And central bankers are caught in this policy trilemma of you can hold two of the three constant. And the three legs are free capital mobility, free exchange rates, monetary autonomy, right? And so the Japanese economy being what it is, predicated upon open capital flows, I think it's fairly safe to eliminate the capital controls from the decision tree. So I think it boils down to a dilemma. And the dilemma is, okay, do they want to fix the exchange rate or do they want to protect and hold the line on JGBs? Or I should say, do they want to exit yield curve control, which is what they had been threatening? But after crying wolf with no follow through for many, many times and essentially jawboning, okay, well, even though CPI is 4%, but we still think it's okay to remain accommodative. And their so-called rate hike was to take negative interest rate policy to essentially like 10 basis points or something like that. It's really a joke, right? So the market is finally calling them out on this. And so the question is, okay, Japan being an ally of the United States has swap lines with the Fed. And so they can tap the swap lines and try to hold down a whole dollar yen and intervene, which I'm sure they're thinking about doing. But all of that comes at a cost. It's not as if it's a free facility. I wrote in 2022, I just basically said, the way to think of a swap line is think of it like a, I think that I used a prime brokerage analog for thinking about FX swap lines, right? So if you think about the Fed as the prime broker to the rest of the world's central banks, you could think of it in a currency crisis situation. You can think of the rest of the world's central banks as being short U.S. dollars and U.S. dollars becoming hard to borrow. The Fed extends a special borrow facility that's expensive and allows the other central banks to avoid getting bought in. But the problem is the other central banks are still short that USD and they still have to repay that swap line. So nothing comes for free. So they have to make a choice. And the problem with the BOJ is that it owns, I think, 54% of all outstanding JGBs. So when they say they want to exit yield curve control, how can they do that? So I think this is literally a choice of bad versus batter, right? Because if they let the JG bonds actually find their market determined rate, it will essentially bankrupt, not to mention all of the other institutions that own it. So their other choice is to let the yen devalue. And frankly, I think that's the less bad choice because while it imports commodity-based inflation for a net oil importing country like Japan, on the other hand, they're also a goods net exporter. So they benefit from a weaker yen. I think it's definitely the less bad choice. And we can use that same argument for essentially the ECB and the PBOC.
It's interesting. You played to my Sicilian over the weekend, because for you folks, you fans of Homer out there, you'll know that it was the Straits of Messina that you're talking about in terms of lesser of two evils. And if you got too close as a sailor or a helmsman, if you got too close to the rocky shoal or the six-headed sea monster, you obviously were going to get caught up in that. Conversely, if you tried to avoid that, you'd get caught up in the whirlpool. So the lesser of two evils was figuring out what you're going to get less screwed by. But what's interesting is the narrowness of the Straits of Messina. So you could be out there sailing and everything's fine, and then all of a sudden you get into this narrow pathway that you need to navigate. And it's not lost on me that we've now made our way to this extraordinarily narrow pathway that we need to sort of navigate. And your point is well taken. How is that going to happen? So I say to you this, people will say, wait a second, Guy, wait a second, Danny, Mike, the yen carry trade, that's been a risk on trade for a long time, and a weakening yen theoretically should be supportive. And my pushback is, I think it's to a point, it's like that diminishing marginal returns. You're going to get to a level where that pendulum's going to swing. And I got to tell you something. You know, I thought 150 was the level, and as we're sitting here today, we ratcheted right through 152 and a half, approaching 153. How does it manifest itself into our markets here in the United States? I think it has far-reaching impacts on our bond market, but I also think it has huge impacts on our equity market.
I think it's more to do with the central bank experiment that's been going on for decades, right? That we saw glimpses of it with the BOE when they tried to just do a little something and it cost the PM her job within a week of trying to jawbone the market, so to speak. So I'll add to Guy's point and say, yes, a weakening yen historically has been risk on, but this to me is potentially a blown up lab experiment.
Yeah, oh, there's so many threads to pull on here because, okay, look, the immediate impact is that as the Bank of Japan has to defend JPY or tries to defend JPY, they obviously burn up their reserves in doing so and might become a forced seller of U.S. Treasury bonds. But the bigger repercussion that I'm looking at and worried about, honestly, for the world is that if you look at the yen to yuan rate, it's making the yuan uncompetitive. And China is already saddled with a structural secular problem that might not even be solved with devaluation. But the problem is that I see the yen breaking out here, potentially being a spark for a round of competitive devaluation. I've been posting periodically these charts of the US dollar against essentially every major currency in the world, like something like 25 or 30 different currencies. And outside of dollar Mexican peso, that has essentially been a standout beneficiary of the reshoring or friendshoring boom here in North America. Most other currencies, the best of the rest would be like the Swiss franc that have basically stayed on par with the US dollar. But when you look at a lot of the emerging market currencies, you look at the Indian rupee, and then in extreme cases, you look at the Argentinian peso and the Egyptian pound, there have been severe devaluations already. So I'm very attuned to this because I literally started my career on the buy side on the eve of Asian Contagion 1.0. I joined Canyon Partners back in the summer of 97. So I had a front row seat as to these long and variable lags. When the butterfly first flapped its wings in July of 97 with the Thai baht devaluation. In fact, I was honeymooning in that month in Bali and then Thailand. And I thought I was getting a good deal on everything. And then lo and behold, a year and a half later, it spilled over into Russia, Russian GKOs, and then ultimately led to like a big risk off in the credit markets, which led to a huge bailout, which now ironically has set the stage for, I'll call it Eurasian contagion 2.0 potentially. And I've been saying that like this notion of a dollar wrecking ball 1.0, which when I first started using that term was back in 2022, recognizing that the bull market in oil in 2021 would lead to a very hyper-vigilant Fed and hyper-hawkish Fed. And it caused that sort of US dollar ball 1.0 in 2022. And then the dollar backed off quite significantly and everybody thought inflation was contained. I think the potential here is for a US dollar wrecking ball 2.0 where it's not necessarily the Fed's going to out-hawk the rest of the world now. It's the rest of the world going to out-dove the Fed because the U.S. economy is just so much stronger than the rest of the world. we're out of sync. When you talk about the repercussions, if dollar yen continues this way, I see it careening into dollar yuan. Dollar yuan is the big kahuna, obviously, right? Because they have a closed capital account. And if they even let the spigots open a little bit and to a more freely determined rate, I think there is a very, very severe devaluation there, which will export a huge deflationary pulse out of China, which in a way is the Fed's best friend, right? I think that's ultimately the equilibrating force that the Fed needs in order to cure our domestic inflation problem.
So, Michael, you were describing during your honeymoon leading up to the rise and fall of long-term capital when genius failed. And I think we all agree that if we have a substantial move in volatility and or in certain products in the market, you will start to see, quote, blow ups of funds that most people have never heard of, that there'll be unwinds and things that will start to occur, just given the amount of leverage that's in the system. But the thing that I'm kind of looking at now that I think is presenting itself that may be the scariest of all is exhibiting stagflation. And if we are starting to see a slowdown, certainly in the U.S., there's no question in certain pockets that's affecting U.S. consumer. We see a company by company basis reporting, but when you put the puzzle together, things are certainly slowing. The Fed doesn't have the ability at that point then to stimulate the economy by doing anything because inflation is either staying elevated or even some cases what we're seeing today, increasing. What does that look like? Because I start to think about, oh, you can be bearish, you can be bullish, and then you get scared. What does that look like potentially stagflationary environment?
Really challenging situation because the so-called quote that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. But there's always something that's a little bit different. And I know that a lot of people have been flocking to gold. And probably I'm guessing that a lot of the gold strength has been the result of Asian central banks freaking out a little bit and buying that gold. But see, this is where we're talking about very treacherous waters indeed, because you know what happened during that 97-98 crisis? Gold went down. And I actually wrote about this in my weekend piece. And I think it had to do with the relative steepness of our yield curve back then. So if you're a gold bug, you got to really, really pay attention to what's happening to the shape of our yield curve. Because if we get a steepening, like I think we're going to, and you know, certainly today, a long bond is down significantly, I think it could go down quite significantly more. And if our yield curve starts to bear steepen here and make the long end a relatively more attractive reserve asset relative to gold, you might have a similar issue. So I found it very, very interesting that gold actually fell during the Asian contagion in 97-98.
Now, Mike, it's a fascinating correlation, and I'm glad you brought that up. And I am never one to say it's different this time, because quite frankly, I have no idea. So you'll never hear that come out of my mouth. But this is what I'll say in terms of what I'm looking at. Gold, and let's just drill down for a second. Think about what gold's been rallying upon. 10-year yields were 3.8% at its trough. They've now on either side of 4.5%. Gold has been rallying throughout that. Historically, that's not an environment where gold would rally. Gold's also been rallying, obviously, on the strength of the United States dollar. Typically, not an environment where it would rally. It's rallying, by the way, going from 6 rate cuts priced in last October to probably 2 or less than 2 now. All the things that would be headwinds historically, maybe they're still headwinds. Maybe gold would be a lot higher, but here we are. And your point about central banks, in 2022, I think central banks bought approximately $71 billion worth of gold. I think it was 1,171 tons or so, which at the time was a record. They basically did the exact same in 2023, and they're on pace to do similar this year. And I think Bank of China is probably on the top of that list. So there are a lot of reasons to be concerned that you point out, but there are also a lot of reasons to say, holy shit. And what I've said, Mike, and I'm curious, I've said this for the last year and a half, central banks are hedging their ineptitude. They know exactly the problems that they've created, and gold is what they're reaching for in order to hedge that.
It might not even be central banks hedging their ineptitude. It might be geopolitics too, right? Because you saw that, like with Yellen coming back from China, one of the headlines that came out of that meeting was that we're not averse to potentially sanctioning Chinese banks if they continue to help the Russians. It could be a prophylactic measure to counter that, right? It's a very muddied picture, Danny, to your point. And I'm trying to figure it out as much as anybody else in terms of how to navigate these waters. And yeah, it's hard, really hard.
I would just say that also the advent of crypto that did not exist in the last crisis has highlighted, or at least the thought process has been highlighted about faith in central banks and just faith in fiat currencies and so forth. And you look at crypto, it's approaching $3 trillion all of a sudden in terms of, you know, its global market cap. Gold has moved, to Guy's point, from $10, $11 trillion to $15 trillion here. So you've effectively have increased, certainly crypto's doubled. I'm just going to guess the number in the last, whatever, from 1.5 to 1.4 to 2. So $1.4 trillion, you basically have shifted over $5 trillion, $6 trillion into, quote, you know, scary assets, if whatever you want to call them, or people that are anti-government or anti-asset. So it's hard to see what you guys are describing, both from a geopolitical perspective and a central bank experiment perspective. Gold certainly could pull in. It's had a big run, but I don't think that anyone owns it yet. The people that own it are the central. I don't think retail owns it at all, unlike crypto. So what are your thoughts on gold versus crypto?
Both of those assets are very difficult to evaluate. I don't own either, by the way. I think the issue I have with them as hedges is I call them both chameleon trades, because at any one point in time, they are either an inflation hedge or a deflation hedge or a geopolitical hedge or all of the above or none of the above. And I'm not smart enough to figure out when it's what, at what time. So it's very difficult for me. If I want to talk about inflation hedges, I do prefer other assets that actually derive cash flows ultimately. But again, there is this reflation narrative or the stagflation narrative that is very powerful, where people look at what assets outperformed in the stagflationary 70s and 80s. I can't fault people for pursuing that, but I guess for myself. So for instance, as a tail hedge, I personally prefer being short bonds than being long gold, but that's just me. It's, you know, potato, potato. I guess they ultimately accomplish similar goals in my mind.
That is fascinating, because if you think about it, you'd rather be short bonds. In other words, betting that yields will go higher as opposed to being long gold. At a certain point, maybe higher yields are going to be that headwind. Maybe they're going to be that stop sign for gold. We'll see. But I follow you on Twitter, as you know. I started this by saying everybody should follow you on Twitter. In response to a tweet on April 1st from Barack Ravid, where Barack basically said, scoop, White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan will travel to Saudi Arabia Tuesday to meet with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and discuss a potential mega deal that would include Saudi normalization with Israel. And then he had a story on Axios. And you responded, which again I find interesting, the geopolitical risk to oil remains to the downside, all caps, but I don't expect MBS to give the gift of extra barrels to Biden. You think it's a first quarter 2025 surprise. So Danny, I know, has been. I've been as well. I've been very positive on the underlying commodity. It's starting to work correctly. The equities have traded in kind. But thoughts on why you think the downside risk is in oil?
I'll even take it a step further. I said in my weekend piece that I think that the notion of a geopolitical upside in oil right now, I think, is an anachronistic trope, because the reason why I say that is this is not the oil market of 1973. Ever since Saudi Arabia acted to unilaterally support the market, I don't know, about a year and a half ago with its cuts, I've argued that they are making a mistake in the long run for themselves and for oil investors like me. Remember that I'm saying this in a way I'm talking against my book, because I have a large, longstanding oil private equity that's a kind of a full harvest equity that I don't trade, but I have the exposure nonetheless. And I'm always looking to find ways to hedge when I think there's risk. The risk I see is that Saudi Arabia has unilaterally supported these cuts to the tune of 3 million barrels per day. So when you look at global spare capacity, including all sources, rest of the world, not including shale, we're talking about 6 to 7 million barrels per day of spare capacity. That's a lot of overhead price elasticity. So while this reflation narrative has definitely benefited oil, and look, oil, the tightness as exemplified through the backwardation of the curve. Remember, that's artificial. I wrote a thread, I think sometime back in 2022, talking about how in 21, what made me very bullish oil, in fact, I was Texas hedged, I was long oil and long my oil private equity. What made me very bullish is that typically when you have the oil market go from a contango to a backwardation for the first time, that's usually a very strong signal that future spot prices will be much higher. And that's exactly what happened by late 21, beginning of 22. The inverse to that does not hold, because by the time a backwardation flips to contango, it is way too late. The simple reason is because usually downward demand shocks come all of a sudden as a result of, for instance, the 1998 Asian crisis, right? You have a very steep drop in demand hitting a supply inelastic curve. And so by the time the market goes into contango, you've already gotten decapitated on a spot price basis. So that's the difficulty with oil here. And so between the overhead spare capacity that I outlined, and I talked about how the geopolitical downside risk is that MBS is known for not liking the current administration, always been much friendlier to the Trump administration. If Trump actually prevails this November, I see that as a big risk to commodity prices, because I could see Saudi Arabia wanting an exit strategy from their unilateral cuts, but they're going to want something in return. If they get some sort of security guarantee with the U.S., what's the one thing that the U.S. cares about from Saudi Arabia? It's not tourism. That's where I see MBS's exit strategy.
Michael, just to wrap up on a name, long idea for those people out there who don't think that we look at things. Funny, I actually worked at MBIA. It was my first job out of college, but I was a muni bond analyst, literally covering airports and colleges and dormitory authority bonds and stuff like that. But it's obviously evolved over the years into many things. You've highlighted the fact that their exposure to the Puerto Rican Power Authority, or what's known as PREPA, may end up as a positive for them. And it's a pretty singular outcome. It's a pretty, right? It's either great for them or it's bad for them. I'm not sure what's built into the price, but I think you've mentioned MBIA as a long idea.
I don't talk that much about idiosyncratic ideas, but this was one that I did mention in my year-end missive because it's an event-driven name. And last October, when this thing dipped down to $6 or whatever, I bought a lot of this. So here's the idea, right? So this is a municipal bond insurer that's in runoff. They are not underwriting any new business anymore. And there's like a good co, bad co element to it. It's a complicated story, but suffice it to say that the adjusted book value, which is, if you think about what that represents, the adjusted book value is essentially, think of it as like the present value of cash flows if they just ran off their portfolio over time. At that time, when this stock traded down to like $6 a share, it was trading at 22% of their adjusted book. So super, super cheap. Now, at the end of the year, they declared a one-time special dividend of $8 a share. $6 stock declaring a dividend of $8 a share. So that's already in the rearview mirror. Why do I like it now? Even after that $8 dividend, the stock is still around six and change. And it now trades at around, I haven't checked today, but it's probably a little bit around like 30, 35% of book value. Now, what's holding it back, the reason why it trades at such a big discount is because the very last obstacle to call it value realization in terms of either a sale of the company or further distributions is a successful resolution of this Puerto Rico bankruptcy, this PREPA. And so I joked a while back saying that on that day when Jensen was doing like the NVIDIA Love Fest, I and maybe a handful of like five people probably listened to 6 hours of the confirmation hearing of the PREPA bankruptcy, which was bone dry, but it's very important because what happens ultimately there, I think, could potentially unlock an additional, I think, $6 or $7 of adjusted book value. The adjusted book value of MBI right now is around 19. And based on where I think their claims are marked, I think there's potential upside to that book value of about like $6 or $7. And if PREPA finally gets resolved, I think they will either sell this company or further upstream dividends. It's a very complicated story, obviously. I like off the beaten track situations like that.
Folks, I encourage you to go read your Homer over this weekend. And Odysseus was faced with the decision, lose a few sailors in the rock with the sea monster or lose the entire ship to the whirlpool. And he was advised it's better to lose a few sailors. But that's what Japan is dealing with right now. So, Michael, we appreciate you joining us and we look forward to having you on again, folks. Urban Cowboy on Twitter, must follow. Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks again to our presenting sponsors, CME Group, iConnections, and FactSet. If you like what you heard, make sure you hit follow and leave us a review. It helps other people find the show, and we also want to hear from you. Email us at contact@riskreversal.com. Derivatives are not suitable for all investors and involve the risk of losing more than the amount originally deposited and any profit you might have made. This communication is not a recommendation or offer to buy, sell, or retain any specific investment or service.